So this is the fourth lecture in a series of six. It's the fourth, it's not the third, it's the fourth. The Reformation and the Civil War, 1485 to 1688. So you can see that the classes are becoming shorter, only 200 years. Only 200 years, it's a very short period of time. And we're going to look at the Reformation. In French you say La Réforme with a capital R. that is to say, the end. That is to say, the end of the monopoly of the Catholic Church in Western Europe, and the rise of Protestantism. And from the point of view today, we think, oh well, Catholics, Protestants, it's nearly the same thing. It's not so important, the difference. At the time, this is an extremely important difference, and it will lead to a lot of conflict, a lot of people being killed, executed, etc. Lots of blood and gore, bless you. We will be having a look at that. And of course, the most important element of this is that religion and politics are the same thing. And so when in the 15th century, if I say, I want a different society, then people will answer, but this society is the one that God wants. And so I say, oh, I want a different religion, which has a different view of what society should be like. So let's have a look. Let's begin with the political side of this, the different kings. Now, I don't know if any of you watch the television series The Tudors. If you like personal stories about very rich people who are a little bit crazy, it's good. And some of the history is okay, but certainly in The Tudors, the importance of individual personalities is exaggerated massively. And the importance of history, ordinary people, economics is made very, very small. Nevertheless, the different kings and queens are important. So here we have Henry VIII, Henry VI, Lady Jane Grey, Mary I, Elizabeth I, James I, and Charles I. And for example, one of the important things is that some of the monarchs have only a few years to impose themselves. For example, Edward VI, he is king for, 6 years? So his priorities are not stabilised. And the next one, Mary I, she is for only 5 years. Again, her priorities cannot be stabilised. And Elizabeth is lucky, because they didn't die because they decided to die, yeah? They just died. And Elizabeth is lucky, she has 50 years to stabilise her political options. Yeah? So these are very, very, very important accidents, how ill they got. Okay, so we need to begin with the power of the church. The power of the church at the beginning of this period, because the church is not just a big religious movement at this time, it is also a multi-million dollar, well not dollars, okay, if there's no dollars, multi-million pound rich organization. The church owns an enormous amount of land. Many farmers work for the church. The church owns an enormous amount of gold. The church controls most of the education system. It's almost like a parallel state. You have the king and the state, and you have the church. So, the king has his courts, tribunals, and the church also has church tribunals. The king takes taxes from the people, and the people also pay taxes to the church. And so it really is almost like a parallel state. The church is also the mass media of the time, as you know. At the time, if you found a beautiful picture of a cat, you could not send it on Facebook because we had no Facebook. So at the time, in the 15th century, if you had a beautiful picture of the cat, then you might give... Cette comparaison, ça va aller trop loin. J'arrête là. Yes, in any case, the priest spoke to the people every Sunday in the church, and the bishop told him, this week you should say this. And so the church could talk to the entire people, just like television. Remember, everybody went to church, and the priest was very respected. He would give their opinion on the war or another question. So the church was a political organ as well. Now, normally, the king and the church work together. So, for example, the archbishops in England were appointed by the Pope, but the king would say, I would like this person to be appointed archbishop, please, and the pope, no one said yes. So very often they worked together, but sometimes they came into conflict, and sometimes big conflicts. At one point, the pope excommunicated everybody in England. Il y avait un moment où le pape a excommunié l'ensemble du peuple anglais. And of course, today, if I say, I excommunicate you, you don't care. But at this time, it was very, very important for people. So that's the enormous power of the church. And at this time, there is more and more criticism of the church. I told you about criticism of the church included in the works of Geoffrey Chaucer last week. And one enormous revolt against the church is led by Martin Luther for religious reasons, for theological reasons. Now, he has different ideas about God and about society. Now, this is not surprising. There were many revolts against the church. In England, I mentioned the Wycliffeites who translated the Bible into English. In France, there were the Cathares. In what is now Czechoslovakia, there were the Hussites. Every now and then, there was a revolt against the church. What is new about this revolt is that they won. In the past, they always lost. And this time, they won. And so the big question is, why did they win? Why did the Protestant Reformation revolt against the Catholic Church win when so many other revolts lost? It's a very simple idea, and that is that society had changed. And the Protestant idea got support from the new commercial classes, the new rich, who were not so interested in land and stability and aristocracy, and who were more interested in commerce and money and capital, who wanted a more modern society. And so the old church, which said, the structure of society must not change, this is what God wants, was not so appropriate for the commercial classes. That we want change, we want a new, more dynamic economy, so let's have a new, more dynamic religion. Because what did Protestantism say which was different to Catholicism? Now, I could do several hours on this, I'm simplifying, but here are some of the big new ideas for the Protestants. Now, some of them were very easy, for example, against corruption in the church. Well, okay, there were always people against corruption in the church. There still are today. Yeah. So that's not so surprising. The biggest, most important is the second one, for a personal relationship with God. That is to say that Protestantism, there are different variations in different forms of Protestantism, but the essential message of Protestantism is that what matters is your individual relationship with God. You can talk to God and God can talk to you. This is Protestantism. The old Catholic way of doing things. If you have a religious problem, you talk to the priest, and the priest talks to the bishop, and the bishop talks to the cardinal, and the cardinal talks to the pope, and the pope talks to God. Yeah? The pope is the voice of God on earth in the Catholic religion, and everything comes through the hierarchy. This is even a little bit true today in some parts of the world. I was in a Catholic family in England, and we didn't have a Bible at home. We were very religious, but we didn't have a Bible. Because the priest reads the Bible and tells us what he thinks. That's the Catholic way of doing things, if you like. And so this, in fact, this personal relationship with God, it appears to be a religious idea, and it is a religious idea, but it's also actually a revolutionary idea at the time, not today. Yeah, at the time, it's a revolutionary idea because it says the old idea where everything is hierarchy. The Pope is the personal representative of God. The king is chosen by God. All of the hierarchy is correct. Do not change society. That's the old idea. And the new idea is that your individual interpretation of the Bible, we want the Bible in English or in French, not in Latin. We want everybody to have access to it. In fact, it's a kind of democratic idea. I don't mean that the Protestants were Democrats. They were not. But there is the beginnings of this kind of idea. And all the rest comes from it. Less separation between priests and others. The Catholic priests had special clothes. The Catholic priests are not allowed to marry. Why are they not allowed to marry? Because they are very special people, very different from everybody else in the Catholic idea. The Protestant idea says, no, everybody has an individual relationship with God, so the priest is not so important. Yeah? The priest doesn't need special clothes. And when I say special clothes, there have been people killed because they wanted or did not want the priest to have special clothes. Yeah? So this was important stuff. The last one is also easy, no papal infallibility. Of course, the Catholic idea is that the Pope, on questions of religion, the Pope is always right, because he has direct contact with God. C'est vrai que c'est un sacré avantage. However, of course, the Protestants were obliged to say, no, the Pope is not always right. Now, if you say the Pope is not always right, that means we can all have an opinion. We can all discuss and debate. It's not democracy, but it's the beginnings, because we can all discuss and debate. Whereas if the Pope is always right, there's nothing to debate. So important things. And the last one I want to talk about is this one, no transubstantiation, which is a little bit more complicated, but I'm sure you'll understand it. Qui a eu une éducation catholique à part moi? Oh, qui a eu une éducation protestante? Musulmane? Juive? Athée? Oh là là, il y en a de plus en plus. On est entouré. C'est terrible. Okay, so I'm just talking about Catholics and Protestants today. The Catholic idea on a Sunday. As you know, communion in the Catholic Mass is a very important moment. And according to Catholic theology, at the moment of communion, before it is bread, and afterwards, it is not bread. It is the body of Jesus Christ. That it really changes. This is transubstantiation. That is, in Catholic theology, every Sunday, there is a miracle. That it is bread, and then it is not bread. It is something different. And the Protestant idea is, no, it's only a symbol. It's bread before and it's bread afterwards. We just do this for symbolic reasons. That's the Protestant idea. So this is very, very different, because, of course, if the priest perform a miracle every Sunday, then the priest is a very special person. And it's normal that they don't get married, and that they don't do this, and that they don't do that, and they wear special clothes. So let's say that this theological disagreement, is it bread or does it really transform? This is a theological disagreement, but it became symbolic of the two world visions, the traditional Catholic vision and the modern at the time, Protestant vision. This is also a moment when if the church is attacked for theological reasons, the Protestants say, your theology is bad. But the church is also attacked at the same time for political reasons. In particular, many of the new rich classes are angry with the church because the church has millions and millions of pounds, very, very rich, and the church does not pay tax. Yeah? So sometimes it's really considered just simply unfair competition. That is to say, in the north of England, when I think I've got it right, where they're selling animals for clothes and so on, they can be in competition with the church, a monastery or something, also selling animals but not paying tax. So it becomes a political question. They don't pay tax. It's not fair. And this is where you see the rise of anti-clericalism. Yeah, anti-clericalism is criticism of the church for political reasons. Not for theological reasons. Because this is a time when society is changing very quickly. In particular, in 1477, that's symbolic, the first book is published in England. Not the first book in the world, the Germans were first, but the first book is printed in England. That's a tremendously important date. Because slowly then, you don't. Before 1477, if you want a book, you must copy it. It takes a long time, okay? And it's very boring. After 1477, you have books. Now, books are tremendously important. They will transform every section of society. For example, agriculture. Before 1477, you wonder, what is the best way to deal with this particular illness in your crops? Oh, I will ask the magician. And then I will ask the oldest person in the village. It might work. But after 100 years after the first book, so oh, get the book on agriculture. There's a book on agriculture. The priest has it, I think. Yeah, and let's have a, so even agriculture. You don't imagine agriculture being dependent on books. Agriculture was transformed by books and every other aspect of society as well. So what we have is that in a changing society, Protestantism proposed a religious view of the world which helped the classes which were rising. There is a livre célèbre, comment ça s'appelle, le capitalisme et la montée du protestantisme, quelque chose comme ça. Now, I wouldn't like to give be too simple about this, but I think there is something that made Protestantism more appropriate in this situation. So here we have a picture of one of the practices in the Catholic Church which was criticized, and this is selling indulgences. This came to be considered as corruption. Let me just explain it for a moment. Perhaps you remember, in Catholic ideology, you have three options when you die. You die and you are completely good, you go to heaven. You die and you're completely bad, you go to hell. You die and you've sometimes been good and sometimes been bad, so you have 100 years in purgatory, and then you can go to heaven. Okay. Now, at this time, the priests had special documents called indulgences. 50 years less in purgatory. I will give it to you, but it will cut €1,000, please. Okay. I'm not joking. This was a real practice, selling indulgences. That is to say, they were selling authorization to spend less time in purgatory. This was very criticized. This was considered to be corruption for a large part of people. There's a statue of Martin Luther. And I need to keep moving. Martin Luther I mentioned, but he's not the only leader of the Reformation. And for example, here is John Knox, who was one of the Reformation leaders in Scotland. This is not him, this is a statue. There you have the Tudors. Okay, I need to come back to the politics and these kings and queens and what happened when they dealt with this. So you have the different kings and queens in a changing society with a criticized church. What are they going to do? And the first of these is Henry VIII. And it's a fascinating story because Henry VIII, for political reasons, will separate the church in England from the church in Rome. Political reasons, very simple. I'm sure you know the story. He married somebody and she didn't give him a son. And so he wanted to divorce her and marry somebody else. Now, normally, the Pope would say, okay, the Pope had often approved divorces for kings, it was not a problem. But there was already a conflict between the king and the Pope for other reasons, and so the Pope said no. And so Henry was very, very extreme in a way. He said, okay, we are separating the church in England from the church in Rome, and I, Henry VIII, I am the new head of the church in England. Notez bien. The church in England, not the church of England. Henry VIII did not want to change the theology of the church. He was not a Protestant. He separated the church for religious reasons. However, once he separated the church for religious reasons, the most conservative people in the church ran away to France because they were friends of the Pope, and the most radical people inside the church, the people who liked some of the Protestant ideas, became more and more influential. So Henry VIII wanted a separate church. He did not want a Protestant church, but he rapidly got a Protestant church because of the political situation. And the two important moments here are the dissolution of the monasteries, en fait, la nationalisation des monastères. Alors c'est vrai qu'aujourd'hui, quel intérêt, on les voit comme de vieilles pierres. The monasteries was millions and millions of pounds, lots of gold, silver, and so on. And so Henry VIII says, oh, I'm the head of the church now, so I think I'll close all the monasteries and take all the gold and give the gold to my friends. Yeah, that was the basic situation, dissolution of the monasteries. This was not done in complete situation of consensus. The Pilgrimage of Grace, donc le pèlerinage de la grâce, en fait c'est une révolte contre. The Pilgrimage of Grace is the name of a religious revolt against the separation of the churches. So the Pilgrimage of Grace was organized by people who preferred the old church with the Pope, and they fought and died For this, yeah. So people thought it was important, yeah. It was important, died, you know. C'est comme PSG et Marseille, plus ou moins. Okay. Here is Henry VIII's palace at Hampton Court. If you're lucky and you go to England, Hampton Court, it's worth a visit. And here is Henry VIII, when he's a little older, a gentleman who went a little bit too often to KFC, I think. But there you go. And there he is again. This is one of the monasteries, what is left of the monasteries. They destroyed the monasteries. When they took the gold and destroyed the monastery. And that's one of them, the ends of one of them. And then you have the Pilgrimage of Grace there, being represented then as a kind of crusade. Now, of course, at some point, Henry died. Of course, he had a lot of wives, and some of them got killed. That's not very important, but there you go, just in case you wanted to know. When he died, he did finally manage to have a son. He did have a son. And if you want to know the exact genealogy of the different kings, then go and ask somebody who knows about that. Edward the sixth then became king, but he had a problem. He was very young. Je sais pas s'il avait 9 ans ou 12 ans when he became king. He was very, very young, yeah? And so, in reality, it was the kingdom was controlled by his friends and advisors, yeah? A group. And in fact, what happened was that this group was very much a Protestant group. That is, they were people who wanted the different reforms. They wanted less special treatment for the priests, more of the Bible in English, etc., etc., a series of Protestant reforms. And Edward VI took the church in England and made the Church of England. Fundamentally. And there are two very important reforms. Of course, there are 20, but I'm only giving you two. Number one was the Book of Common Prayer. That is to say that Edward VI ordered, he said, every church in the country must use the same book of prayers, this Book of Prayers. This was very, very important because once you separated from Rome, people began to discuss, what is our opinion about this question? And in different parts of the country, they had different opinions. And this became a little dangerous for the king. And the king said, no, we want uniformity. We want everybody to use... We want a little debate, but not too much. Everybody must use the same book. And the Book of Common Prayer was invented by Edward VI, well, his friends. And it's a very fascinating book because it is still used today in the Church of England and also in the Episcopalian churches in America. So that's a successful book, I think. And the second big change then, priests have the right to marry. Priests may marry. Now, this is not a detail. This is a tremendously important reform because this is the official declaration that priests are not different from everybody else. And priests, according to the Protestants, and priests do not carry out miracles on Sundays. So they don't need special clothes, and they may marry like anybody else. Okay. And this has developed the foundation of the church. The Church of England has been able to be much more flexible with the question of priests. And in fact, today in Britain, I think 20% of the Church of England priests are women today in Britain. Yeah. So it's one of the first religions to go forward. Lots of women in the story. So there's the Book of Common Prayer. That's a later edition of the Book of Common Prayer. The Book of Common Prayer and Administration of the Sacraments and Other Rites and Ceremonies. In particular, very often the Protestants would say the most important book is the Bible. If it's not in the Bible, I don't want to do it. So look in the Bible. Many things are not in the Bible. One of the things they hated was this. You can see what it is. It's a wedding ring. Now, look in the Bible for a wedding ring. There are no wedding rings in the Bible. Not at all. It's in fact a pagan thing. Whereas, of course, wedding rings in Catholic churches are exchanged, just like everywhere else, yeah? And so there was a big campaign at this time to say, no wedding rings. It's anti-religious. It's against God to have wedding rings. It was some sort of idea. But of course, you know that religious attitudes to things which you wear make people very angry and cause big conflicts, even today. So after a few years of Edward, Edward dies. He's still very young when he dies. Let's get to the thing. And you have this rather interesting situation of Edward VI dies, and he says Jane Grey will be the next queen. And she is some relation. I can't remember exactly which relation. And you can see she has a problem here. We call her Lady Jane Grey, so that doesn't sound like a queen, does it? And in fact, what happened is it was announced that she should be queen. It's like, you know, somebody comes, the king's down, would you like to be queen? It's a really good job, would you like to be queen? That is to say that the Protestant friends of Edward wanted Lady Jane Grey to be queen. However, the Catholic section of the court was more powerful. And so silly Lady Jane Grey said, yes, okay, I'll be queen, and then was executed. Okay, so Lady Jane Grey was kind of queen for a few days, and then she was executed because the Catholic section was more powerful. And Mary became queen, and you got the restoration of Catholicism. So this is a rather unusual situation. You know, it's a Catholic country, it's a Protestant country, it's a Catholic country, it's a Protestant country. What does this mean? Well, first of all, the most important thing is the second one, a link with Rome is re-established. That is to say that, you know, the contact of the Pope said, yeah, we want again to be accepted into the Holy Catholic Church. The priests who had married their wives were rather sad because they were obliged to leave their wives. A few of them left the country and went to Germany, where there were lots of Protestants. But you leave your wife. I'm sure a few of them must have been happy. Okay, so just an old joke there. She also had a lot of conflict with some of the Protestants, and a number of them, a few hundred, were burnt at the stake. That is, they were executed by fire. Now, why do you execute by fire? Because the aim is to frighten people. Like, for example, if I burn him in front of you, you will be frightened. Okay, yeah, it's pretty frightening to watch people burning. Mary was a Catholic queen and the Protestants won the Reformation, she is always known as Bloody Mary. In fact, the Protestant kings also executed people, but they won, so nobody remembers that. And there's a particularly important story of Cranmer. Cranmer was a wonderful story. So Archbishop Cranmer was a Protestant leader, he was arrested for being a heretic. They made him sign, I have changed my mind, I am now a Catholic, signed Archbishop Cranmer. Okay, they were very happy. They said, oh yeah, it's great, he's changed his mind. Of course, he was tortured. But, you know, he's tainted his mind. They said, we're going to execute him, but first of all, we want him to make a big speech in the church in Oxford to say, I was wrong. Protestantism is wrong, and the Catholics are right. And this was, of course, a political option. They wanted a big public speech by a very important Protestant leader saying the Protestants were wrong. So it's a very posse spectacle, show trial. When the Archbishop Cranmer was brought to the church in Oxford and he made his thing, he said, I have signed many documents to say that the Catholics are right, but I now announce that I don't agree with this, and as for the Pope, I denounce him as the Antichrist. Okay, political fail for Mary. And he was, of course, executed. And he continues, he's a very good speaker. He said also, this is my hand. With this hand, I have signed horrible documents. When I go to the fire, I want my hand to burn first. C'est ça un politicien, c'est mieux qu'aujourd'hui. Okay. So Mary re-establishes Catholicism in Britain, but, and there is an enormous but, look at the bottom. The gold the land, all the riches, which Henry VIII gave to his friends, Mary said, listen, rich people of England, I want to go back to Catholicism, but you can keep the gold that my father gave you, or the previous king gave you. Okay, so this is very, very important, because this means that although Catholicism was re-established in Britain, the Catholic Church did not get its money back. So the Catholic Church under Mary was not an enormous rich institution. Also, it has to be said that the Catholic Church had a bit of bad luck. Unlucky Catholic Church. She died after only 5 years. If she had lived 20 years, maybe she could have stabilized Catholicism in Britain. Maybe, I don't know. But she didn't. She died. So let's have a look at this. Thomas Cranmer, I just mentioned to you, who was executed. And there he is being executed. You can see that he's putting his hand out. I want my hand to burn first, because my hand has signed these terrible documents. And here you have another one, the burning of Catherine Curtius and her two daughters. Now this is a story, this was written by a Protestant historian, Fox, and he says, this woman was put on to burn, and she was pregnant. And when she was on the fire, her baby arrived and fell out of the fire, and so the soldiers threw it back into the fire. Yes, that's how to treat Protestants. Okay, say, my mother was a Catholic, and in the north of England, it's like, you know, the conflict between Catholic and Protestant still exists to some extent. And certainly, you know, we used to say a joke where you'd say, I went home to my mother and I said, Mother, my girlfriend is Muslim. And my mother went, what? Is she a Catholic Muslim or a Protestant Muslim? And it's a kind of joke, but not completely, you know. There's just another joke, also a Catholic joke. It's the young woman who goes away from home and comes back 2 years later, very rich, lots of money. And she says to her Catholic mother, her Catholic mother says, how did you get all this money? She says, well, I'm a prostitute. And the mother goes, oh. And then she comes, you know, she faints, and she comes around and says, what did you say? So, oh, I'm sorry, mother, but I've got a lot of money because I'm a prostitute. Oh. Oh, I thought you said Protestant. Yeah, okay. Enough. So, let's move on then to the most successful, Queen Elizabeth. Queen Elizabeth, 1558 to 1603. So, very, very lucky in that she has almost 50 years to stabilise the Anglican Church. And so what she does is she establishes, well, when I say she, of course, it's a group of people. She establishes a Protestant church, but which makes some compromises. And here are some of them. First of all, attending Anglican services is obligatory. Yeah? You have to pay a fine if you don't go to Anglican church. So this isolate, you have two groups of people who refuse. Here you have the Anglican church, okay? You have, let's get this right, yeah, you have the Catholics, people who really want to be Catholics, who want to work with a Catholic priest, and they refuse to go to Anglican church. So they pay fines, or they go to Anglican church and pretend. At this time, if you look in the houses, the big houses in the north of England, the manoir, very often behind the bookcase there's a little room to hide the priest. Because later on in Elizabeth's reign, priests are executed, and so the priest has a special place to hide. And it's a kind of, very often, the local sheriff, they know, but they turn a blind eye. So attending Anglican services is obligatory. The New Book of Common Prayer, published in 1559. So again, the same one for everybody. And in particular, the 39 Articles in 1563. The 39 Articles is still today the principles of the Church of England. Now, this is the 39 Articles, it has to be said, have certain compromises inside the 39th articles. Some of the theological questions are not treated. Say, okay, well, everybody can keep their own opinion. So what you have then is a successful Anglican church. When I say successful, I mean stable. And inside the Anglican church, you have quite a lot of different opinions. Some of the Anglicans are a little bit like Catholics without the Pope. Traditional ideas about priests, special clothes, yes. We prefer if priests don't marry, etc. And on the other side, you have inside the Anglican church, some Anglicans who are very Protestant. Oh, the Reformation has not gone far enough. We want more reforms. And then this is the Anglican church. Outside the Anglican church, you have over here the Catholics, and over here the dissenters. The dissenters, for example, groups of dissenters went to America in order to have a society with a different religion. Les pères pèlerins, on dit, the pilgrim fathers. Parfois on dit, en tout cas en français, on a tendance à dire les puritains sont partis en Amérique pour fonder une nouvelle société. Pour être strict, they are dissenters. The Puritans, are in the strict sense, are the people inside the Church of England who want to reform the Church of England, who want the Church of England to be more Protestant. The dissenters think that the Church of England is shit and they want a new church. Yeah. Okay, so there's Elizabeth I, quite successful. And there's a lot of politics in this because at certain moments Elizabeth is nicer to the Catholics, because Spain is an important country in Europe at this time, and Spain is Catholic. And so if Elizabeth wants to have an alliance with Spain, she must be more gentle with the Catholics. Yeah. So there's a lot of politics in it as well. There you get the 39 articles there. Because I had a Catholic education, I went to a Catholic school. They taught us all about the Catholic martyrs. These are some of the Catholics who were executed by Elizabeth, John Southworth, and so on. In fact, the Catholics in England have not forgotten Elizabeth. And when we were little, we had to sing a song, "I would like to be a martyr like these people." It's like, I'm 7 years old, you know. Whoa, is this obligatory? You know, it's pretty awful. Okay, so let's move on. So don't forget then that Elizabeth was lucky. She had 45 years, yeah, so she stabilized the situation. And every now and then she would change. Sometimes she would be very hard on the Catholics. Now priests can be executed, and other times not so hard. And the same thing of the dissenters. Sometimes she was quite flexible and sometimes quite hard for political reasons. James I became the new king then in 1603. Of course, people were very excited because the Catholics thought, maybe the new king will not be so hard on Catholics. And the dissenters thought, maybe the new king will not be so hard on dissenters. And in particular, inside the Church of England, the Puritans say, maybe the new king will introduce some more reforms. We've done some Protestant reforms, that's good, some more. And the Millenary Petition was a petition by priests saying, we want more Protestant reforms. We haven't gone far enough. In particular, the priests still wear some special clothes. This is not good. And interestingly enough, in the millenary petition, one of the things they wanted abolishing was the wedding rings. No wedding rings. It's not in the Bible. In general, the new King James said no. The millenary petition, no, I'm not interested. I don't want to do any more. But he did introduce one very important reform, and that is that he ordered a new translation of the Bible into English. A new translation of the Bible into English, which we call the King James Bible. He did not translate it, he just paid for it. First of all, the King James Bible is a major literary work. It's very beautiful language. And today, it's still a bestseller today. It's still a bestseller today. In fact, the traditional version of the Bible is the King James Bible. Still a bestseller today. You probably know some little bits of it. There are some popular songs which are written from the texts. So, and at the same time, so that's the religious side. But on the political side, you have increasing conflict with parliaments. Now, Parliament, I mentioned Parliament a couple of weeks ago as the moment when the king agrees to discuss with the rich people in the country to take advice. This becomes more and more important. So two things. First of all, let's not get confused. Parliament does not mean democracy. The people in Parliament were not in favour of democracy. They were in favour of the king not deciding on his own, but taking advice from the aristocrats and from the bishops and from the rich people. However, there was more conflict because the economy was changing more quickly. And so, in particular, the new commercial classes, they needed new laws. The situation has changed. There's a lot of commerce. We need a more modern society because the traditional society was quite difficult to do commerce in. For example, if I'm the king, 100 years before this, say, oh, well, let's say whiskey. I tell you what, give me 10,000 euros and you can be the only person in the country who has the right to sell whiskey. Yeah. Playing cards, les cartes pour jouer. C'est vous, 5,000 euros. So the personal power of the king was given to allow other individuals to make taxes. Now, if you are a dynamic social class wanting a new economy with serious trade, that this is impossible. A different rule every day, a different rule for every product. It's too traditional, and the idea of modernization is to make commerce possible, big commerce possible. And so this is one of the reasons that more and more over 300 years, the parliament will be more and more eager. We need a parliament which will advise the king and make new laws because the situation keeps changing. We cannot rely on the old system anymore. King James was not so happy with this because King James says, no, you don't understand. I am king because God decided, so shut up. Yeah? Okay, this is the divine right of kings. And so increasing conflict with parliament. And so every now and then, the king was obliged to call Parliament because only Parliament could declare new taxes. But then very often the Parliament began to criticise the king, and so the king closed the Parliament again. So you get this going on and on for a while. Here are two of the subjects. The picture here is two of the subjects of the millenary petition. I mentioned the wedding ring, and here's the other thing. This is the special clothes for the priests. Now, those of you who have a Catholic upbringing, you know that the priest wears this colour at this time of year and a different colour at a different time of year. And I learned this at school, but I've forgotten it. Yeah, very important ritual side of it. And this is the King James Bible, containing the Old and New Testaments, translated out of the original tongues. Yeah, the original tongues usually being Hebrew and Greek would be the original tongues involved. Now, I just want to say one more thing about the Bible, that the translation was very political. Because in reality, certain words, if you translate them in one way, it sounds Catholic. And if you translate them in another way, it sounds Protestant. So it was a really quite a conflictual thing. Oui, je crois que il y avait un mot qui pouvait traduire baptême ou lavement, and that makes made a big difference. Yeah, so there's some really important things going on there. So James was around for 22 years, 1603 to 25, yeah, so he had a certain thing. There's one more thing that happened under James, which I forgot to mention, is there was a conspiracy to kill James. This is Guy Fawkes, planned to explode Parliament at the very beginning of the 17th century. And this was a group of Catholics who wanted to kill the king. A group of Catholics tried to kill James I. They were not successful. And so the result, of course, was that the king was much harder on Catholics after that. His son James, Charles the First, was king from 1625 to 1649, and he had a rather original career in the sense that in 1649 he stopped being king because Parliament chopped his head off. That is right. That's to say that 140 years before the French, we chopped the head of our king off in the Civil War. Now, the English Civil War, then, I will talk about in a moment, conflict between king and Parliament. The king, who defended the idea that all the decisions should be made by the king, and the Parliament, who did not want a republic, but the Parliament wanted a king who obeys Parliament. The Parliament won. Now, this period, the English Civil War, you can use different words for it. Some people say the English Revolution. Now, was it a revolution? Well, on the one hand, at the beginning of the period and at the end of the period, there is a king. On the other hand, at the end of the period, the king is clearly not the boss, and Parliament is clearly the boss. So I must admit, I'm quite tempted by the idea of the English Revolution. In any case, Charles I increased his personal power, and Parliament got more and more angry, and this led towards the Civil War. Though he is increasing his personal power. The conflict got bigger and bigger between king and Parliament, and one day the king arrived with soldiers in the Parliament and said, okay, I want the five people who are leading the criticism of me. And the Parliament said, we don't know where they are. Yeah, which of course is what you would say. And so the king went away, and then the Parliament said, okay, we want parliamentary soldiers in front of the Parliament to defend us from the king in case he comes back. Now, remember that the Parliament's job is to give advice to the king. The king is the boss. The Parliament's job is to give advice to the king. So the day when the Parliament says, we want soldiers in front of the door, from a theoretical point of view, it is the beginning of the Civil War. Yeah. And indeed, Charles waited a few months and then went to Oxford and sent out a message, if you want to defend your king, come to Oxford, we are forming an army. And you got the Civil War going on. Now, so there was a civil war between king and Parliament. Now, civil wars are very interesting because they have a very interesting effect on politics. Because, of course, in normal times, you have some people say, oh, I'm very interested in politics. Oh, I'm not interested in politics. You have a choice. When there's a civil war, you don't have a choice. Yeah, the army is arriving in your town. The king's army is arriving in your town, okay? Are you supporting the king's army, or do you want me to kill you? You're very interested in politics suddenly, aren't you? Everybody is interested in politics during a civil war. You can't get away from it. Once you take away the power of the king, many, many new ideas arrive, and many new groups are established who want to go much further. The Parliament wants a king who obeys the Parliament. But a lot of the new army, the Parliament's army, are much more radical. And indeed, Winstanley was a leader of one of the group called the Diggers, and his slogan was, England is not a free people till the poor that have no land have a free allowance to dig and labour the commons. So you can imagine the Parliament says, we need to defeat the king. Please, everybody, join our army. We want England to be free. Oh, yes, I'll join your army. I want England to be free. I want to abolish the rich. Is that okay? No. That's not the idea at all. And in fact, inside the parliamentary army, you had tremendous debates. Because in order to defeat the king, the Parliament was obliged to mobilise the ordinary people. It was a bit like Robespierre. However, the ordinary people had their own ideas. And you got really very, very important debates about whether land should belong to anybody or not. And of course, because this is a period when politics and religion are the same thing, when you say, I have some new ideas about society, say, form a new religion. Oh, okay, I'll form a new religion. This was the normal thing to do, yeah? You form a new church. So the levellers, the diggers, and many more, some of them a little bit unusual. One of them said, clothes. Clothes are very bad. We're going to abolish clothes. It's kind of the punk rock of the English Revolution, somehow. Here you get the situation with the royalists. This is in time. Yeah, the royalists are in red. They are quite successful at the beginning, and then they lose, and the parliamentarians win. Yeah, the parliamentarians win in 1645. And they arrest the king, and then there is an argument. Some say, okay, now what we need, we want the king to sign to say that he will follow the parliament, okay? And the people say, no, we must execute the king. Yes, we must, big argument. The king escapes and starts the civil war again. And finally, the parliament arrests him again, and they decide to have a trial for the king. So we've got le procès du roi. I said, okay, we need judges to judge a trial for the king. Would you like to be a judge? I'm very busy. I'm sorry. No, I'm very, very busy. People were terrified. But they did find them, and the king was executed. And for 11 years, England was a republic. For 11 years, from 1649 to 1660, England was a republic. And I don't have time to tell you any details about the Republic of England. Now, this is a political word. Some people say the 11 years. Some people say the interregnum, entre deux règnes. Some people say the republic. Oh, it's a much more different idea. The word they used at the time was the commonwealth. La chose commune, the commonwealth. La richesse commune, république républicaine, la chose publique, the commonwealth. And they attempted to stabilize a system without a king. They were not successful in stabilizing, that's for sure. 11 years later, a group of parliamentarians wrote a letter to Charles's son, who was in France, I think. Said, please come back. Charles wrote, James II, he wrote, I would like to come back, and I promise that nobody will be punished for what they did during the Civil War. That's very important, of course, an amnesty, very, very important, because otherwise there was no case for stability. And so in 1660, you get the restoration and you have a king again. And in general, people are not punished for what they did during the Civil War, except the judges who were part of the trial, the people who voted for the execution of the king, were punished. And in particular, one of their biggest leaders, Oliver Cromwell, he was dead, but they dug up his body, cut it into little pieces, and put it on the walls outside the palace. Because they had a message to say, yeah, we are not very happy with this gentleman. Now, Oliver Cromwell is interesting because, first of all, he was leader of England, and then he died, and then he was dug up and executed. And today, there is a statue of Oliver Cromwell in front of the Houses of Parliament in London. So it just shows you can, even after your death, you can have good times and bad times. Next week, I'm going to be looking at the Industrial Revolution and the Empire. So thank you for listening. That's all for today.